I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Real Spoilers, powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent Breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real Spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, yet another co-video recovery.
I think we're going to be doing these for a while.
I think we are too. So, but we came up with our theme, so we didn't have to keep fighting over an infinite universe of movies to choose from.
I thought, isn't everything opening back up in May? That's pretty soon.
Sure, if you're in St. Louis, it's May 4th. We'll see how well that goes.
Yeah. Even if it opens back up, like, nobody, the studios aren't releasing anything, so.
Yeah.
Where, you know, what are you going to go see?
I always thought that was funny when, like, they're talking about theaters, and, oh, theaters can open back up, and it's like, what do you think they're going to show? Like, I mean, yeah, someone might go watch the, whatever, 50th anniversary of Godzilla, you know.
They're just going to stream Netflix to the theater.
Yeah.
You could be onto something.
I know.
So it's episode 571. I guess let's go around the table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. Quick shameless plugs. Don't forget, we're available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can go there and rate, review, and most importantly, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Of course, check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, which is called the League of Show Sharers, and you can become a League of Show Sharer member officially, a real honest to goodness one, by sharing an episode. People who were kind enough to share the episode this week were Griffin Fox Smith, Julianne Jordan, Librarian Cynthia, Susan Carlson, Chris Sanders, Ron Johnson, Travis Tewitt, Gabriel Lugo, Chris Williams, Brent Smith, Chris Magic Man, Aaron Marlowe, Lane Levanway, Carl Clarkson, Jason Weese, Dylan A. Lang, Tammy Sherman Powers, and Timmy Tuzun. So thank you very much for sharing an episode. And finally, our Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers. For $5 a month, you get all sorts of bonus content, and you help us out, and we appreciate that. So what we are doing moving forward.
Well, before we get into that, I have a bone to pick with Jason Weese. Hey, wrote us a fantastic message on the group page about the positivity that we kind of try to encourage.
Right.
But also, I'm going to call him out for his love of Batman Returns.
Now people,
he called it a very underrated movie.
People, well, we hated it, so that would be underrating it, I suppose.
Yeah, now, that's true.
Now, you do realize, Joe, that we're in the minority here,
apparently,
right?
Like, holy God, I did not expect the amount of, I don't want to call it vitriol, but the amount of defense,
yeah,
that people came to it for Batman Returns, because it was like BVS levels.
It's the 90s equivalent of The Shape of Water.
Well, yeah, and the thing is,
I say that in jest. I'm just giving Jason the guff, but yes, the amount of people who are just like, no, it's the greatest movie. Somebody said it was the greatest comic book movie ever made, and it's like,
Yeah.
I don't even have a response for that.
I think for people that listened to the episode, we were very much on Front Street of saying, like, I mean, Joe and myself, that we've always loved the movie and we went into it expecting to love it. And it's not like we went into it trying to tear it apart or anything. And, you know, I know that a friend of the show, Ryan Terry, has a very strong opinion of the movie, and he's written essays on it and all that stuff. And so our review was by no means an attack. We did not gang up on the movie. You have to understand, and I am the one that chose that movie, and I specifically chose it so we could talk about a movie that everybody loves. It backfired big time because I did not expect to feel the way I did. I didn't think Joe would feel the way he did. I didn't know what Tom's opinion was, but he hates everything, so I presumed that probably...
I remember when the movie came out, I didn't really particularly care for it, but I just was like, okay, I guess, like, either one, I haven't seen it in 30 years, and maybe, you know, maybe I'll have a different opinion now, or maybe I'm just the odd man out. I mean, it happens. We all have movies that we don't like, but everyone else seems to love, right? And so I was...
Or in my case, vice versa.
Right. And so...
not the movie vice versa, but, like, yeah.
but yeah, so I was just like, okay, cool. Like, if you don't want to, you know, you want a good movie to talk about, whatever.
So, you know, anyway, so this clearly it was not meant to be any kind of an attack. And I know Ryan was frustrated because it seemed like a one-sided discussion. And, you know, he was adamant that we should have had someone on to defend the other side. But what I tried to convey to him was we were the other side.
Yeah.
Tom was supposed to hate the movie and Joe and I were supposed to love the movie. That's how it was supposed to happen. But I'm not going to come onto the episode and lie about it or to, you know, not be honest. And the thing is, like, you know, and he's like, well, when you realized it was one-sided, you should have bubbled. It's like, no, we're recording an episode. I'm not going to reschedule our entire
mid-episode, be like, oh, by the way.
Yeah. So, you know, Ryan, you know, I said, well, maybe at some point, whether, you know, if we need a bonus episode down the road, a Patreon or something, I said, we'll have Ryan on. Maybe we can have him try to convince us that we were all wrong. But
good luck.
And in defense of Batman Returns. A special Patreon episode. Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, but
ironically, I think I was the one who ended up liking it or having the most positive things to say about it.
We did a complete heel face turn.
Yeah.
We did.
Like Kevin and I turned heel and Tom turned face.
Like, I mean, I didn't love it, but I was like, because I was like, I don't like it as a Batman movie, but as a Tim Burton movie, like, yeah, it's good to look at. It's pretty.
But that's the thing too, though, is we don't have, you know, 5 hours to talk about it, but I love it for the exact same reasons, Tom. I you know, I talked about loving the aesthetic. I love the art direction. I love the costumes. I think it's a great Tim Burton movie. The problem, I think all the problems we had was applying Batman to it. That was our number one complaint.
That was the end of me liking Tim Burton. Like, that's the tale. Like, I think Sleepy Hollow is the last, like, Burton flick that I enjoyed. And then he goes off the rails for me.
I don't know. I mean, I've really enjoyed some of the stuff he's done, you know, since then.
No, I trust me.
He could definitely kind of go up his own ass sometimes, but but he's still made, because Ed Wood is after this, right?
Yeah, Ed Wood, Sleepy Hollow, and I think that's, and then Big Fish after Sleepy Hollow?
And okay. I
think
Big Fish is his masterpiece.
And I think that's a great example that I don't like Big Fish at all.
Nope, me either.
Oh, wow.
I think it's really just, it's like... I mean, I know every movie by virtue of definition tries to, like, you know, manipulate you emotionally, but, like, I can just really see the strings on that one, and it just does nothing for me.
Oh,
not a thing.
That's too bad.
Nothing of any kind. Ed Wood, that is his masterpiece.
I think Ed Wood, it's a toss-up between Ed Wood or Sleepy Hollow. I love Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah.
But I think Ed Wood's fantastic as well.
But anyway, back to this week's
movie.
Yeah,
that was it. Sorry.
No, that's fine. So so we had been doing a 0% project, and then that kind of morphed into a misbegotten sequel. So not necessarily 0% on Rotten Tomatoes, but not stellar turns. And then we decided that in an effort to have good movies, we'll try this again, Kevin. We'll pair our misbegotten sequel with their presumably less misbegotten origin source. So we will do the original movie and then a sequel that maybe didn't stick the landing. So this week we will be tackling Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, followed by Butch and Sundance, The Early Days. a movie that is so forgotten, they don't even get the title of the movie right on the Blu-ray.
Like, oh, really?
The Blu-ray that I was able to acquire, the movie is called Butch and Sundance: The Early Days. On the actual disc itself, it says Butch and Sundance: The Early Years.
Because that should have been the title.
Well, it should have been the title, but it's not. And
yeah,
there's problems with that movie.
Oh yeah,
timeline wise.
Yeah, it's I will say it's not an. I didn't think it was a horrible movie. It was just aggressively mediocre. But we will get to that.
Yeah.
So before we get to that, we will tackle the one of the finest movies I think ever made, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, directed by George Roy Hill.
I don't know how you can defend that it's not. When I started working at Blockbuster, you just get to a point where you've seen everything, right?
Right.
So you just start going down the aisles. And I remember picking up, I was on a really weird Robert Redford kick.
Nothing weird about that.
Well, that's true. But I picked up Jeremiah Johnson, All the President's Men, and this.
Jeremiah Johnson is, it's a slow movie, but it's
very slow.
But it's beautiful. The mountain scenery, snow, and like that's a great looking movie.
And the gift that nobody realized was Robert Redford until like 6 months ago, of him like nodding, beard.
Yeah, that's where that's from. Yeah,
yeah, right, right. So I just kind of fell down this rabbit hole, and this, I remember, you know, I was a big fan of like the spaghetti westerns, and I just felt like the westerns for me at that age were like the movies that my dad watched, and I just had no interest in them.
Totally.
And then I watched this, and I was like, oh, are they all like this? Because I have screwed the pooch if I have been sleeping on movies like this. This is, I don't know if the words will ever truly describe how wonderful this movie is.
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is, well, first off, one, no, all Westerns aren't like this.
No, I figured that out.
Yeah, and there are some amazing Westerns, but they're not like this. And this movie was not well reviewed when it came out. Like, it was, it got, you know, kind of a fair to middling sort of reviews because it was such a different sort of Western. And I think it's a really classic, maybe the ultimate example of people going in expecting one thing and getting another and not knowing how to process it.
Yeah,
because you know, like, there's, the movie is anachronistic, deliberately so, right? Like, I mean, they use present day music, which can be kind of jarring, and I honestly don't care for the music choices, the song selections in the movie, like,
yeah.
But also the way Newman and Redford carry themselves they have a very modern sensibility, and I think we're more used to seeing that now because it's been aped. But at the time, that's not what you saw in Westerns. And the other thing that people recoiled at, which we'll get into from a plot standpoint, is that they don't fight. They run away. Like,
sure.
Like,
sure.
40 minutes of this movie, if you know, really the entire plot of this movie is them running away. And like, when William Goldman sent the script out initially, this first studio sent it to was like, yeah, like, cowboys don't run away, so you need to rewrite this thing. I don't know what you're doing, but you need to change it.
I feel like that aspect makes them more endearing, and that adds to the emotional punch of when they have to fight.
It does. But I think also what makes them endearing is what's so tricky is just the casting, right? Because,
oh, for sure.
Because
yes,
you see what it looks like. And there's, as actors, there's nothing wrong with William Catt or Tom Berenger, but they're not Newman and Redford.
I will say, as far as like casting somebody based on looks.
Yeah.
Like, those are close.
They did.
Like, if you,
from an,
they're so close to,
yes,
Newman. Yeah, Newman, yeah, and Redford.
Absolutely. Like, some of those shots of Berenger with when he's wearing that bowler and the fur coat.
He looks like, yeah, just like him.
Oh, my God.
Even William Catt. When William Catt finally grows the mustache.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got the same hair. William Catt is definitely a little on the smaller side. Like, right. Redford always comes off as, like, big.
Right.
Like, a big man. So, William Catt kind of has a smaller stature. But in the face, and even in some of their, the way he would deliver dialogue yeah. sounded just like him.
Yeah, no, they did a good job. It's just, yeah, and again, we'll get to that
we'll
one.
We'll get into that one.
But it's an interesting juxtaposition. And but yeah, they didn't want Redford. Newman had to fight for Redford. He wasn't a name yet. And this was originally called The Sundance Kid and Butch Cassidy. That was the way Goldman wrote the script and submitted it. And then they had cast Newman as Butch Cassidy and Steve McQueen as Sundance. And
that's too much cool.
It's too
much. Too much cool. Yeah. You can't do that much cool. And then you get Robert Redford and you're like, well, all right.
Yeah. And so they when then McQueen dropped out and then Newman fought for Redford and they went ahead and cast him. But then they were like, well, we can't have Redford's character's name be first. So they flipped it to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. So there you go.
Which just sounds better. I mean, I know that we're used to it now, right. But honestly, it just flows better to me.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out in my head if that's because I'm used to it or if it's just flip, but it does seem like it flows better.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand that that's the whole, like, we've been programmed, we've heard as much, but it's like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid seems to flow better than the Sundance Kid and Butch Cassidy. I don't know.
I don't like it.
Yeah, it's just the way that it comes out of your mouth. You're like, oh, no, too many syllables up front. Right.
Yeah, and I think and it starts with a soft syllable, Sundance, mm-hmm. instead of Butch Cassidy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
so
take that, Hollywood.
Yes. So I guess, and also, we should also, just real quick before we dig in, talk about what a hit this movie was. It made $102
million. In what year?
1969. That's made $102 million in 1969. Adjusting for inflation, that's $721 million. And that's essentially domestic. I don't even know if they kept track of international box office back then. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Is there any two dudes who, besides maybe Steve McQueen, who like just were just cool? Like, I feel like anytime I see Paul Newman, that dude is always
the epitome of cool, for sure.
Right, but it's just like he's got a different, you know, when I think of like James Dean and Steve McQueen, there's just Paul Newman just has like a different level of confidence, I feel. Like he's got, like, I don't even know who I could describe, like who I could compare it to today.
I think The Rock.
Maybe, you
know, the natural charisma where it's just like it seems effortless.
Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Brad Pitt is a yes.
Yeah.
I could Clooney. See definitely. That's the best comparison.
Clooney.
And then there's Clooney kind of has like that smarmy cool.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, like that
Brad
that
Pitt has a laid back,
not overconfident
mellow,
cool, but
cool.
Like, yes,
yeah.
Brad Pitt has mm-hmm. like that Jeremy London, whichever London was in Dazed and Confused. Like, that kind of cool.
Yeah.
You don't see that often
Jason
anymore.
London was in Dazed and Confused.
I can never remember
Jeremy
which
London's
one it
the
is.
Mallrats one that went crazy, apparently.
Oh, right. The one that said he was kidnapped but wasn't kidnapped.
But apparently Kevin Smith says he's back in for the sequel, so I guess
you can't have Mallrats without T.S.
I know, but I mean, sometimes you have to when they're, you
That's
know?
True, yeah.
But he says
unless
he's back,
your best friend, you just keep propping him up there hoping that he can get his lines right.
Yeah.
You know who has it in the right role, but he doesn't take the right roles very often, is Matthew McConaughey.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
I could definitely see. And then, so you just have these two. Sometimes when you get two charismatic dudes, they don't work together on screen because
they're fighting.
Their egos, they're fighting, you know, like both of them are fighting for that spotlight. When these two, when Robert Redford and Paul Newman are on screen at the same time, you are drawn to it's. I don't think there's been anything like them since.
They have great chemistry, and that's what really makes this movie, is the two of them in the leads, like that casting. And even though it was fortuitous that they came together and it wasn't the first choice for that pairing, but wow, I don't know that this movie would have ever became a success if it weren't for just that, you know, the way they clicked on screen.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, in The Sting as well, like it's just, it carries over there.
And that's why The Sting was such a big deal when it came out, because it was repairing them and repairing them with the same director.
Yeah. And it's not the same writer, right?
No, I don't.
It's a different,
no,
it's a it's different writer.
Yeah, because this was okay. written by William Goldman, who would write Stand By Me and The Princess Bride, Misery.
Masquerade?
Did he? I don't know.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Marathon Man. Like, he's considered one of the greatest screenwriters.
I was thinking that I was looking at his IMDb yesterday, and he did a lot of stuff before this that I don't think, like Masquerade, I think is, but there was a Paul Newman flick where he's a private detective.
Right.
Harper.
Okay.
And it's so good.
Yeah.
Like it's Hoopa.
Harpa.
Hoopa. but if you like the like Point Blank with, Lee Marvin,
right.
It's in that vein, but you get to have the cool Paul Newman, in the,
yeah.
you know, instead of, you know, the not so cool Lee Marvin.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know, much like Batman Returns, I don't really think we need to go through this one beat for beat, because I feel like this is probably, you know, everybody has seen this movie.
Well, I hadn't seen it until we watched it.
Are you serious?
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
No one ever told me to watch it.
That's
so what happens when you grow up without a father figure in your house.
Yeah.
Like for real. Like, I'm not even like bagging on you. Like, cause like my dad left, or, you know, not like abandoned us, but like my parents got divorced when I was like 12, 13. And so like, I didn't really watch Westerns. They were boring. They were the epitome of boring to me. And so I didn't start watching them until my early 20s, because I'm like, so many people are raving about certain ones, I'll go check them out. So like, I was late to the game on a lot of Westerns.
Tom has told me about a lot of Westerns. Like, yeah, that's the thing. Like, no one in my family, like my mom never watched Westerns. My grandma didn't watch Westerns. And like, my grandpa introduced me to Blazing Saddles and Mel Brooks movies, you know, but that's about as close as a Western that we ever got to. So I've been discovering a lot of these over the years. But yeah, I never had gotten around to this one. I knew the cover. I mean, I knew about it, but
well,
yeah,
there's a poster of it in the podcast studio.
Yeah, like, definitely.
Absolutely. There is. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's funny because when you finally see the end of the movie and you see that iconic shot that you've seen
everywhere,
it's interesting to see how or where that comes from.
So what did you think, Kevin, like as your first time watching this, what did you think?
I thought it was really good. I mean, the chemistry is undeniable. I loved the modern take on it. I love the way that they acted. I thought it was really refreshing, really unique. Yeah, the two of them paired were great. I did like the anachronistic stuff. I mean, it did feel a little weird and out of place. Like, I get how the music, I mean, it's a little jarring, but I also, there was something that I liked about it. And what I thought was really cool was I was expecting these guys to, you know, roll into every town and start shooting people up and all that. And the fact that Butch Cassidy was the gentleman bank robber and, you know, Sundance was his partner and went along with him, and the way that they basically avoided ever trying to hurt anybody, and they were more celebrities than people fearing them. I thought it was interesting. And then especially since the whole last half of the movie is them on the run, like, I did not expect that at all.
Also, I think people lose sight of the fact, like, this movie's 50 years old, and when it was made, it wasn't that far removed from when it occurred, right?
Yeah.
And so
that's true.
It would be like making a movie today that was set in like 1950, and it was recent enough history that Butch Cassidy's sister visited the set and actually was in some of the commercials.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so, and she died like, not all that long ago. I mean, all things considered, like, I think it was like the late 80s maybe. But, and so like, and according to her, now obviously she's got a vested interest in protecting the legacy of her brother, but
sure.
like she felt like they got it pretty right in terms of how he comported himself and how he, you know, how he interacted with people, and that he wasn't this ruthless killer. Like, a, you know, like, there's been a lot of glorification of like Jesse James and cowboy movies.
I was just going to ask you that. Like, do you think that era is over? Like, there is that glorification of Jesse James and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and like the, you know, the Western outlaw. I feel like that's not a thing anymore. Like, you're not gonna like what's the word?
You can't root for criminals now. I mean, the closest you're going to get is someone like an anti-hero like Walter White in Breaking Bad, a fictional character. But, you know, like how you root for a bad guy, but he's bad, you know? But
yeah, you're not going to root for Ted Kaczynski.
Right. You're not going to root for someone going over and knocking over banks because they're sticking it to the big corporations.
I just watched Waco, like that 6-part miniseries.
Yeah.
That story, depending on who you believe, like they definitely toy with your ability to not root. Like, you know, you're not supposed to root for David Koresh.
Right.
But there are moments where you're like, oh no.
I mean,
I'm kind of rooting for David Koresh right now.
You know, like you expect, and I haven't seen that, but I know some of the story, but you still expect the good guys to play by a certain set of rules, and when they don't, it does engender sympathy to someone who is ostensibly a villain, and that's the problem when law enforcement doesn't follow their own rules. Joe,
I think even I follow the rules, but I also even the 20s gangsters, right? Like Al Capone and Babyface Nelson and John Dillinger, like those guys are even. There's a little bit of hero worship with those guys, and I just feel like that's the end of it.
Yeah, I think the way they get away with that is that they would play down the killing, or they would make sure that the killing was someone that deserved it. You know what I mean? It was just, oh, they were robbing from banks and they're rich and they can afford it, so do you really care? And that was kind of how they, you know, that was their kind of end run around that. But also those movies, especially back then, they might glorify him for the whole movie, but then in the last reel, something bad would always happen to him, which was literally the rules, right? Like that was literally part of the film code, which is that like someone, if they were doing bad things, then that justice had to prevail at the end,
or your monsters had to die,
right?
Like that was So this movie is it's a beautifully shot movie. Like do we know where this was shot? Because it is
outside. Yeah,
thank you, Kevin.
It was shot in Durango. Some of it, the train stuff was shot. That was the Durango Silverton line. That's actually where I went on vacation. I was on that train, and I didn't know that it was the train from Butch Cassidy. And I'm like,
how
do you not have signs everywhere in Durango saying that Butch Cassidy was filmed in
the? Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, it was filmed in this town. Like, I mean, I was done. And now I will say there's been a lot of other Western shot there, but I don't know that any of them were as big as Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid.
No, probably not.
But it does make me, watching movies like this makes me miss these big epics. Like, and I know that this movie is more contained of a Western than some other ones, but still seeing the scenery and the outdoors and the beautiful cinematography, it makes me long for a movie like that, and that's why I think going back and watching old movies where they have the big Panavision cameras, the super widescreen, it just gives you a feeling where movies today, especially with how polished they are, and there's so much CG and there's so much green screen and everything. I don't know, and I know that it's every old person out there, quote unquote old person, like, oh, they don't make them like they did in my days, but there just is something missing. I mean, I didn't grow up in these days either that I'm watching, but I do long for movies that look like this, and you know that's why when Tarantino goes, I'm going to film.
Tarantino and Nolan.
Yeah, when they
are the two that still do it.
When they film on film and they say, oh, you know, presented in Panavision, CinemaScope, whatever, and you see these gorgeous shots,
The Revenant was like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it was, you're right.
On film, but like from a scenery standpoint.
It evokes those emotions, though. And so just watching this movie and following them, it was gorgeous and it was an experience. And that's why I think, you know, that, again, the last half of this movie is very much like them just trying to run away. But you're invested because, one, you care about them, and two, it's breathtaking to look at. Like, you're really enthralled by the scenery.
You know, they talk about how a lot of people consider this like a perfect screenplay, and I don't think they're wrong. That opening scene, just, you know, hitting the high level stuff, the opening scene is a masterclass in an exposition where you see it's, you know, it's first off, it, you know, it opens with, you know, silent real footage of Butch of old Butch Cassidy movies, just kind of showing what they people how they perceive them in real time, you know,
unless you watch it in Spanish.
Well, yeah.
So my Stars app,
did that happen?
My Stars app defaulted, so it has language and subtitles, and so the default number one option is Spanish, and the second option is English. And so when we watched it, it was like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, like it was someone with an accent reading the title cards, and so you're supposed to be watching this silent movie, and I went with it for like until Paul Newman started speaking Spanish, I went with it. So it was pretty funny.
I had a similar reaction when I saw the Martin Scorsese movie. Was it called Silence?
Yeah,
yeah.
And someone's and talking.
When they started the film, I saw it in the theater, but with the screening. But when they started the film, there was no audio, and so the whole crowd spent like 5 minutes trying to figure out like. Is this an artistic?
Am I supposed to watch it like this?
Is this an artistic choice? The film is called Silence. That's and then hilarious. Finally you see somebody talking and no sound and you're like, okay. And then they had to stop it and start it over.
Well, I was watching this with Katie and she's like, Paul Newman can't speak that good of Spanish. I'm sure of it.
Oh, we find that out later.
So we stay at right. Yeah, and so we totally, started it over and we saw it was silent. And I'm like, oh, well, that's cool. I'm like, so we're the only people that probably have watched this not silent. Interesting.
Yeah. But then, you know, you see him viewing the bank and just how quickly it establishes that, you know, the times are changing and there's no place for them. And then it cuts to the card game and then now you establish, you know, Sundance's gun shooting prowess. Mm-hmm.
I wonder, you know, as I was watching this, Tombstone is one of my favorite movies.
When I was watching this, I go, I know what
there's a lot of Doc Holliday taken from Sundance.
We gotta do Tombstone eventually. No, wherever we do it, it's such a good movie.
It's so, Tom, you've seen that, right?
I have not.
Whoa.
What is happening?
We are definitely doing Tombstone at some point then.
Snake Plissken and Batman in the same movie as friends.
Yeah. The movie doesn't follow them the whole similar. Time, but when you talk about charisma and the chemistry together, it's like, yes, those two.
Tom, if we ever get around, we should actually probably do Tombstone next week, just because now that we've talked about it.
No, we've already selected next week's movies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But if you, when you see that, there is a lot of, like,
I've seen both. I've seen clips that makes sense. You know,
Val Kilmer is doing his best Robert Redford impression the whole time with tuberculosis. But yeah, so go ahead.
But the card game scene at the beginning, you know, is great. I also like how it starts with silent movies and it takes a while before the movie gets very talky. Even though it's a very talky movie, that opening scene is still those opening two scenes, the bank and then the card game, are both very quiet. There's not a lot of talk.
Change color.
Yeah, the color slowly comes in, but even then, when the color's all the way in, it's still a very like muted movie in terms of color. You know?
It is, but I like how they phase you in from silent pictures and like footage of them, and then they go to black and white, then they go to like sepia, and it slowly fades in, and it's a really nice transition to acclimate you to the time period so that it's not just a jump of completely modern all of a sudden.
Yeah, and they keep throughout the movie going back to the sepia tone stuff to kind of, you know, at key points.
On their way to Bolivia.
On their way to Bolivia, and then at the end. Obviously, the final shot. But
right. Yeah.
But in that card game, one of those card players is Sam Elliott.
Oh,
really?
That's right. Yeah. I read that somewhere, and I forgot to look for him.
You can't see him, and I don't think he talks. Like, it's just his back.
Yeah. Does he have a mustache?
You never see his face. Like, the only card player
Tom,
you see
I know what it was. Now, Katie read about it. She said this is Sam Elliott's first film, and you only see his back.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Because I'm like, I didn't see him in the movie.
Here's how much of a baller Sam Elliott is.
Okay.
First movie ever, right?
Yeah.
Don't see his face.
Mm-hmm.
Married to the female lead in the film.
I mean, as soon as, you know, she's another one of those actresses where as soon as you see her,
yeah,
you're like, holy guacamole. Like, I get it.
Yeah.
But and
yeah.
I one of the things that I love is there is that, there are moments when she is with Butch.
Are you talking about Catherine Ross?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Where she's, you know, she's riding on, they do, you know, raindrops keep falling on my head, and that she's riding on the bike, and she even says, she's like, you know, if you had met me first, would we have been together? And I love that Butch never wavers.
Yeah.
And he was just like, he's not a creep. Like, he's just like, not like, he treats her like a sister, almost. Mm-hmm. But there is that hint of...
Yeah.
And something,
and you know, people love to apply subtext to movies, especially back in a day when they couldn't tell certain types of stories. And you know,
as in like they're a thruple.
Well, you know, there was a lot of essays written that, you know, are Butch and Sundance gay? But now, like, there's a lot of people that say that like this is a polyamorous couple, and that
yeah.
they kind of do all the things that entails.
I feel like it's weird. As I'm watching it, I was like, okay, so Sundance is the physical part, because he gives almost zero affirmation of feelings.
Right. He's very emotionally distant.
Where Butch is the opposite.
Yeah.
Where he's gives her the feelings, but no physical
right.
contact.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, so it's very interesting to see that play out in 2020.
Totally.
To how that couple would work.
It's also an interesting movie for me to revisit at different points in my life, and like seeing it now at almost 50 versus seeing it when I was, you know, 15 or 17. Like, it, you know, I read things very differently, you know?
sure.
Yeah. And you know what I love about this opening scene, and when you said it, the exposition and all that, it's really well handled. And also to introduce you, if you're not familiar with these characters, that guy's reaction to knowing that he was about to draw on the Sundance Kid is all yes. you need to know about that character.
It's yes. It's Billy Bob. It's Billy Bob in Tombstone.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's the same, right? It's the same thing where he's,
they took it from that. Is what yeah. you're saying. Yeah.
But yeah, it's almost the exact same scene where he's just like, and then he realizes what is about to happen.
Yeah. yeah.
It's he's a like, great, never mind. Never
it's
mind.
A great lesson for aspiring writers that like, yeah, another character's reaction can convey everything you need to know about a main character. You know?
Exactly.
That's why we get
exactly.
on movies so hard about their lazy exposition, is when they hit you over the head with something, when the characters feel the need to just sit there and explain it unnaturally yeah. where other characters would not do that. I mean, this was right. a perfect introduction, being that it was someone mistaking his identity, and when he learns about it, boom, now it's like, yes, that's I'm
yeah,
messing
like
with
a,
the wrong person.
A lazy movie would have been like, well, this is Sundance Kid. He's the greatest shot in the old
yes,
West,
exactly.
even though it's the present yeah, day for us.
Right.
And you can't shoot, you know, where yeah. And then Newman's dialogue is great, because Newman's like, he's nagging him, right? Like, he's yeah. just like, you get older every day. Now, that's a fact. Like, it's basically
right.
like,
yeah,
I know you're great,
balls.
But at some point, someone's going to be faster. And yeah. so this could be that day. You don't know. And you know, so it's like.
It's so great. I love that scene where he's just like, he needs to ask me to stay. He's like, I'll
yeah.
go. But he's like, and Newman's just like, can you just humor him?
Don't
you
even
just ask him to say
what have
he's
to
like,
mean it.
Okay.
That was so fascinating. What exactly was that? I was kind of thrown off, because again, first time watch with that, but I didn't really get what they were doing there. It was really interesting.
I think it was like it was basically like, I'm not going to do what you tell me to do. And
yeah.
so if you're telling me to leave, then F you, now I've got to kill you. But if you ask
right.
me to stay, now I can leave with dignity. It's my choice to leave the situation.
Reverse psychology.
Yeah, you're not
right.
That's exactly. You're not going to punk me out in this bar.
It's allowing him to save face, right?
Like, yeah. It's the same thing that Kurt Russell did. You know, he's like, you're going to skin that smoke wagon, and you know, dressing down Billy Bob until Billy Bob Thornton's like, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and then go ahead, Tom.
Oh, I was just gonna transfer to the next like really cool scene, which is the knife fight with Harvey
yeah.
Logan.
Oh my gosh,
I love the scene so much, and
it's great.
Yeah, and again, it establishes you establish these two characters back to back, what their core quality is, right? Like, you establish that Sundance is a really good shot. You're never gonna get the drop on him, but with Butch. They turn around and establish you're never going to out hustle him, you know.
Yeah,
and do you know who that is? The actor playing Harvey Logan.
No,
is it? Dang it.
It's Lurch from the Addams
Yes.
Family.
Thank you.
He looks familiar.
Yep.
Yeah. And he's also the narrator from The Incredible Hulk.
Oh, interesting.
What?
The television
the TV show.
Yeah, he was the narrator. He does a lot a lot of voice work. But yeah, that was Lurch from the Addams Family television show.
That character shows up in the prequel.
Yeah, very briefly.
Along with Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah, the prequel, I messaged Kevin as I was watching it. I was like, I think this movie invented fan service.
I think it absolutely did.
Yeah. So this scene when, basically Butch and Sundance are away all the time and his gang, the Hole in the Wall gang, is like, you're never around. How can you be the leader of this gang? So Lurch challenges him for leadership, which is, they end up having a knife fight. But the way that Paul Newman outsmarts him, again, testament yeah. to the script, he's trying to establish rules and he says, there's no rules in a knife fight. And then that's all he needs to say. Okay, then. And he kicks him in the nuts.
And it's so great because you watch Newman cheat, but at the same time, he's not cheating. And it's like, it's
there's no rules.
Yeah. He's like, you establish that there's no rules. So, okay. And he kicks him right in the nuts and on the same beat, rules. There's no rules in a knife fight.
Yeah, it's that's brilliant. Comedy and the cleverness with that. And I mean, I guess he elbows him in the nuts, but whatever, same difference.
Oh, okay, sorry.
It looked like it hurt, whatever it was.
Yes, and, he got hit in the balls. Yeah. Like, it doesn't matter how you get hit in the balls.
And then his other guy, who like was not on board with him, is like, oh yeah, I was rooting for him the whole time.
It was your support that sustained me in my moment of trouble.
Yeah.
I love, is it Reader? Is that the guy's
name?
Where he just has like newspaper clippings in his jacket pocket.
Yeah, the news.
And he's reading it and he's like, all right, I got it. He's like, no, I gotta get to this last part. And he gets to his name. He's like, I just love seeing my name in print.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so great. And then they go to the train.
Well, the other funny part though is that the Lurch guy is like, we're gonna rob the train there and on the way back. And Paul Newman's like, why would you do that? Whatever. And then he finishes fighting him and he's like, hey, that's exactly what we're going to do.
Yeah, like, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
The Woodcock gag, I think, is the best gag of the movie, where the guy's like, look, they robbed the train, and they're going to get the money from the safe car. And
I love
the
relationships between everyone knows.
Everybody's like,
okay,
you win.
This movie's so different than other Westerns, because, one, the time period setting is kind of supposed to be on the outs of all the the outlaws and everything. Like, times are changing and everything is so much more civilized in this than just like bad guys shooting the good guys or the robbers shooting people and stealing it. Like, everyone has a relationship. These are celebrities of the time, and it's like an honor and it's exciting to be robbed by them. And they're there to like shake their hand and say, hey, oh, good to see you. They're like mesmerized.
Yeah, you can go home and tell a story. Yeah. Like, I got robbed by Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
Kid. It's so different. There's hardly any fighting, but what's more interesting is watching this unique relationship between Butch and Sundance and all these people who are standing by like excited about being robbed.
Yeah. And then
they break in. Of course, the guy's like, I can't do it. I can't let you in. And finally, they have to blow the door off. And the first thing that Butch does is goes to check on the guy. And he's like, my God, are you okay? And he's like, they're not paying you enough for this crap. They take the money and they run. And then they go home and they're going to, this is where we meet the girl, Etta, thank you.
Who is really a prostitute in real life.
Really?
They're not. I've seen conflicting reports in terms of whether or not she was a teacher or a prostitute, because apparently William Goldman flipped her from people said she was a prostitute, but he flipped her to a teacher because he said he didn't believe she was a prostitute, because most of the pictures you would see of prostitutes from that era, they were really rough looking, and that the pictures he saw of her, like, she was legitimately a very pretty and well-kept lady, and he didn't think that. He was just like, he just wasn't buying it.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you meant the actress was a prostitute.
No.
What? No, she was an actress.
No, she was an actress. Thank she had you. Just okay. been in The Graduate. She's the main yeah. the main
right
from The
exactly.
Graduate.
But yeah, so then they go back to hit the same train, And this time, same guy, Woodcock, and then
oh god, Newman's the extra like, locks on like, the safe and everything.
I mean, he's like, "What are you? Why would you do doing? That?
You got you broke into it so easily. We had to do something. Oh, yeah. So-
you broke into it so easily last time. We had to do something. So they put too much dynamite on it, and this time they blow it to hell, and they kind of lose the score, is my interpretation. But because they've hit this same train that has the same owner. This owner enlists the most badass lawman.
Oh, LaForce.
John LaForce.
Which is a straight reference to Mallrats.
No, it's the other way around.
That's what I meant. Yeah. Mallrats is a reference to
me. Even wears a white hat.
Same hat.
I was thinking Joe had to be flipping his lid because that's the reason why the security guard in Mallrats is named LaForce and wears a straw hat. Like, you know, never having seen it before and loving Mallrats, it blew my mind.
Yeah,
it was great.
It's exactly that. Yeah. And they have like, you know, they're on the run now and they realize they got to get out of Dodge. They cannot stay here.
That scene where after the first heist though, and they go to the brothel or wherever the saloon that they're at and the guy's outside trying to mount a team to go after Butch Cassidy.
Oh my God.
The sheriff, the marshal of the town.
And
he's like, who's with me? And no one's there because he's like, we got to do something, right? We got to go after him. And no one's volunteering. It's hilarious because you can tell they're all sitting around like, we're not going to go after Butch Cassidy. Like,
yeah, even the guys are like, no, thank you.
It's also the flip side of the movie deals a lot with the future, right? Like the bicycle's kind of about the future. But like that's part of civilizing the Old West is that it also means people aren't going to be as apt to go hunt down criminals. Like, hey, dude, that's your job. If the cop showed up at our house and said, hey, there's a criminal on the loose, come help us. I'd be like, go F yourself.
Right.
You know? No.
So that was.
I mean, I'll go, but no.
That was a great scene. And the gag with the bicycle salesman who was like, yeah, half my job is gathering a crowd. You've done that for me. And he's trying to sell bicycles. Like, so good.
But I do like that they're sitting up in like while the marshal is trying to gather a posse to go get him, they're sitting up above them,
right?
Just being super chill,
they're
drinking some beers.
They're probably
like,
all the way
dopes?
To wherever, and then they scroll over and they're there. That's great,
right? So now they're on the run.
They call this the super posse. These like this posse of people that's tracking them down. That's like, you know,
it's the Justice League of cops.
Yeah. And so something I thought was brilliant about this whole part here, you know, at least this whole super posse tracking scene, they never use their telephoto lenses to zoom in on the super posse. I thought this was so brilliant because we get to see it from Butch and Sundance's view. In another movie, I told Katie, I'm like, in any other movie, they would zoom right in and we would see LaForce's face. We would see who the trackers are. We would see all this stuff. But we see it from their perspective, and they look like little pinpoints, just like if you were way up on the mountains, you'd say, like, I can make out objects, but I can't tell what they are. And I thought that was so smart, and again, such a great way to let the story unfold when they finally figure out who is involved.
And it's so much more menacing. There's just this, as much fun as the movie is, there's also this cloud hanging over it of menace, of like, they're getting closed in on, and it's not
as good as our heroes quote unquote are. They're not really one step ahead. Like, they're almost like two or three steps behind, because this troop is constantly on them the entire time. Like, they're never not getting away,
because they have
there's distance between them, but that distance is closing rapidly,
and this super posse is well, I mean, really good. They have the skills, but they also have unlimited resources, because now it's just a matter of pride. Because there's a line where Butch says, he's like, well, they're spending more money to catch us than we ever stole from them. He's like, if they just
gave us that money, we'd leave them alone.
Like, if you just pay me what you're paying them, I'll stop, you know?
And so they found out that there was an actual Indian tracker. That's the only way, because they were following them. Like, every trick they tried wouldn't work. So they had this expert tracker, and that's how they ended up basically cornering them up on the mountains, and they do that big jump, which is another really fun scene.
You know, as a kid, I always thought that was the end.
Like, the Thelma and Louise.
I always thought that was the end.
And
of the
man, that's a great effects shot. Like, I did not realize that was not a real stunt. I mean, it's a real stunt, but like, it's a matte painting. It's a stunt jump against a matte painting. Like,
no,
it's not really on a cliff. And I'm like, looks good.
I watched it on a...
It makes you hurt for stuff like that.
Yeah. I watched it on a huge projection screen in HD, and I didn't notice that, so...
I know. It's amazing how good practical effects could be.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
artistry. I was just talking to somebody the other day, that's why the prequels suck. A, the stories are awful, but B, there's... When Abrams took over at episode 7,
yeah,
like he brought back the practical effects and it felt like a Star Wars movie,
right?
Those prequels just are super, you know, like rubbery.
Yeah,
agreed.
So they pack up Etta and they, you know, this is the scene where you're not really sure if you're supposed to be rooting, you know, you're supposed to root for Sundance, but he's not nice.
Yeah.
To Etta. Like there's the whole scene where he kind of makes her strip, and even like watching it yesterday,
it's a weird game that those characters play and the film plays, because the way they first introduce her, like they let you and they hold that moment for a long time. I remember watching this movie as a teenager and being like, is he gonna rape her?
I was there with you,
and it's just like, I'm like, how am I can't like this character now, and then she smarts off to him, and you realize that this is just a game that they play.
Yeah, I told Tatum we were watching. I go, this is a role play thing. There's no way they're gonna make Sundance Kid rape someone in the first 10 minutes of this movie. There's just no way.
Well, at gunpoint, like there's just a level of uncomfortability, just the way it's going down. And then when she smarts off to him, you're like, oh, okay, I don't feel as bad. All right. I can go back to liking this guy.
No,
it's enthusiastic consent, right?
Yes, exactly. And when he finally says, he's like, all right, you can come with us, but I swear to God, you start whining, you start doing, I'm leaving you behind. And she's even kind of like, yeah, I'm going, but like, there's a level of him not really wanting her to come along.
Well, I think that she should have been with Butch Cassidy. I mean, I think that they're together.
Well, so knowing what we know, though, Kevin,
yeah,
she can't be.
Well, but I mean, who knows what happened since then? I don't know.
Yeah, like
we'll get into that more. But because of what we learn, and then because of what we don't see and don't talk about, I just don't know that that's still the situation. Honestly,
maybe not.
Yeah, I would agree.
But I feel like with Butch, though,
I think it's just a respect thing between the two guys. I think that, you know, I mean, obviously she's with Sundance, but to me, I think that whole bicycle scene, I mean, it speaks, you know, speaks all everything you need to know without saying it. That, you know, I mean, it's just a matter of who got there first, but it should have been.
Yeah.
Should have been.
Yeah.
I guess that's
true. I guess he is hooking up with prostitutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Throughout, like, before we get to Bolivia.
And I love her speech here, though, where she's like laying down her guidelines, which is like, I'll do this and I'll mend your wounds and I'll do, but there's one thing I won't do, and it's like, I won't watch you die.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I think it's probably her shining moment in the film, and her role is kind of thankless. Her and the director did not get along. He actually banned her from the set.
That's kind of a
She filmed, she operated a camera because they were one cameraman short.
Yeah, she showed up on one of the shots. I forget which one it was, but like they were a cameraman short, and she wanted to learn about filmmaking, and the cinematographer was like, "Yeah, come on over. You can work this camera for me. We're short." And she did, and George Roy Hill did not like it, and he banned her from the set, except on days when she was being filmed.
But, from what I've read, George Roy Hill wasn't
Yes, that's
good.
I would,
filmmaker, but he what a.
I mean, he came in with a vision, and they were going to capture it, but he was not
one of those guys.
And I think he could be collaborative if he deemed you worthy. Like, it sounds like him and Newman got along fairly well, but it sounds like they also butted heads, and you know, it was that kind of old school tough guy filmmaker, like a Howard Hawks or a John Ford kind of mentality.
Yeah, because Newman was trying to convince him to do scenes differently, like the whole time they were filming, and I mean, Newman could never get through to him.
Yeah, he wanted the scene, I don't even know if we'll touch on it, but the scene where they go and they tie up that sheriff or whatever, a marshal, that clearly used to be a criminal, and he wanted that to be the last scene before they went to Bolivia, where and George Roy Hill disagreed, and he was the director, so he won.
Yeah.
No, well, I guess that's the way that works.
Yes.
So they get away. So there's that bicycle scene we talked about. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head is like the huge hit that came out of this movie.
Won an Oscar.
Yeah. And you know, I thought it was really interesting that Burt Bacharach wrote that song. And then the guy that ended up singing it wasn't even the first choice. He ended up doing it because Ray Stevens turned it down. And then
I think Bob Dylan turned it down, too. They originally wanted Bob Dylan.
That was the story that I read in a different article, but from what I saw at Vanity Fair, they said that he initially brought on Ray Stevens. Like, that's like the first actual one they tried to get. And then, like, I think he maybe wrote it with Dylan in mind, but they tried to give it to Ray Stevens. He turned it down. And then they got BJ Thomas to sing it. And, like, apparently he had laryngitis, so that's why it's so raspy. And he thought he sounded awful, but then it ended up being this huge hit.
Huh.
Best laid plans.
Yeah,
but yeah, and so they wrote that song for the movie. They do the bicycle thing where you get that sense of Ella and Butch's relationship, or you know, of what could have been there, and it's a really nice scene. But then anyway, we get this montage, which I thought was fascinating. So did you, Tom? Did you read the story about that they wanted to use the set next door to film?
Yeah, they the set next door was Hello Dolly,
because
it was the same time period,
and they Hello thought they Dolly could film the real scenes, and that's why you only get pictures, because they were going to just go there and actually film them in New York, and they would not let them, because I guess they said they wanted to keep the set a secret or something, like closed.
I think because Hello Dolly was a prestige movie, you know what I mean, like and they didn't realize Butch Cassidy was going to be that level of popular. Hello Dolly was like their, you know, the equivalent of a tentpole picture. They were adapting this huge Broadway musical. They had, you know, Barbara Streisand in it at her peak, and so they didn't want anyone to see the set, so they still went and shot there, but they took still photos and then spliced them into period photos. It's good. It's good looking stuff, though.
Oh my gosh! For the time period, 1969. I'm looking at it, and there's Photoshop today that looks way more fake than those photos.
Yeah,
they did a great job, and they used like something over 200 actual period shots. And I thought it was a really fascinating way to do it. And when I watched it, I questioned it, and I'm like, there has to be a reason they did photos here.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really interesting that they just, you know, they presumed, hey, we'll just use this set. They couldn't, but it ended up working really well. And so I like that transition. I like all that. It shows their journey, you know, all the way to Bolivia. And then the thing is, I kept like yelling at the screen saying like, go straight. Like, you got away. You guys should be dead.
Yeah.
I said, go there and start a farm. And then like 15 minutes later, they talk about, what do you want me to do? Start a farm?
Oh, I think in real life they did. I think in real life, I think they were in Bolivia for like 8 years.
Wow.
And it's definitely a compressed time frame a little bit. And I think they did go straight for a little bit and then didn't.
I wish they would have shown that more at first, because you're like, you got away, start your life over. This was a chance for a clean slate. You know, you could live your life, just, you know, start the farm. And I get that this is their life and it would be hard to do, but I don't know, the way it jumped right into like, oh, hey, let's go check out this bank right when we get here. You know, you're just kicking yourself for them.
I don't know. I took it as like they're addicts.
Yeah. And they think they thought it would be easy pickings, that like, oh,
right,
this little podunk country, they're not going to be ready for two guys like us.
Yeah
exactly. So they start doing their thing in Bolivia and start robbing banks, and then
they have to learn Spanish. They can't rob the banks.
They do. Yeah, right. And I love that. Is it Ella or Etta?
Is it Etta? Okay, Etta.
I think it's Etta. It has to like teach them Spanish. And of course, this is another scene where Sundance doesn't take very, like, he's just not willing to learn, where Butch is like, yep, got it, not a problem.
It's the,
like, he's just rattling
it's
off.
The brains and the brawn thing, though. You know, they're a perfect pairing because of Sundance's skill and Butch's smarts, and I do like how the prequel touches upon that. They're a great pairing.
Yeah.
And that scene was another great gag where Etta and Sundance are in bed, and she's like, oh, we're not going to do anything until you say this. And then they knock on the wall next door, and Butch is over there, and she's like, Butch, what's the way to say this? And he pulls out a crib sheet, and he's reading,
right,
like,
right,
that
right.
was very good, Butch.
And he's like, oh, thank
until
you.
The next day when he can't say the same thing because he doesn't have
right, he has to pull out the crib sheet and then read it off of that. So they're just kind of living their own life in Bolivia, and then they realize that LaFleur is there, He's in Bolivia looking. They see him from the back and they see his hat. And they realize that we got to go. And this is where Etta is just like, I think I'm going back home.
Yeah.
Like they're sleeping. They had to leave their house. They're going. They're sleeping out on, you know, under the stars. And she's like, yeah, this is going to end badly. Like you're going to die.
It's that. I mean, they set it up beautifully in the first part, right? Like that's the best thing ever met her. You know, like I guess in the second act when she says, you know, I'll do this, that and the other, like Tom said, but I won't watch you die. And when she leaves, it's exactly what she said.
Yeah. She's like, I'm not staying.
And it's great foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing. That's,
Cause they're like, they're going to die. Mm-hmm. Like they,
right. They, yeah. That's they, exactly
they're
right.
They're telling you like,
They're not going to inception it.
Yeah,
like these two
aren't
open to interpretation.
These two aren't going to have a happy ending.
Kate leaves. They're kind of sitting on their own, and they're sitting in this restaurant. And this is the final shootout. This is the where all hell breaks loose.
Where they go straight for a minute, and they're going
to. Oh, that's true.
They're going to protect.
Payroll, that's right.
But they end up. They get robbed and they end up killing them and Butch finally kills somebody. He's like, well, we went straight. And
I love the line where Butch goes, I've never killed anybody. And just the look on Redford's face, he's like, son of a bitch, like what a great time to bring that up.
Yeah,
he's like, can you just shoot in between them and hopefully we'll hit one of them, I guess. Wonderful.
Yeah, it's a great reveal, and you can tell by how he always uses his wits to outsmart people. He's never had to actually fight.
Yeah,
right.
It's also a great mirror image of the cliff jump scene, right? Where Redford's like, I can't swim, you know, and like he's got his own reveal of like, I've never killed anybody.
It's weird when we get to this to the next one. Where they're in this one, they're like, we don't know. I don't know anything about you. Like, I don't know your real name.
I know, that's going to be weird, but we'll talk about that next one.
It's going to, we'll get on the next one, but there's just a lot of like, if you're going to make that, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
So this is the big gunfight. And of course, our heroes are up against the wall and they have no way of getting out. And they realize we're screwed. We are surrounded. We took out as many as we could. Let's just go out guns a-blazing.
I like that. You know, we should go to Australia.
I like how he's still planning. Just keep thinking,
it's
Butch.
Nice.
That's what you're good at.
This is the scene on the cover box, the scene on the poster is them coming around that corner and then just hearing the gunshots and then a freeze frame of them in that like sepia tone color that we've seen throughout the movie.
But right up until the end, you know, I mean, this movie, I mean, they are busting balls the entire movie and their chemistry and relationship, like we said, is so believable. It's so lovable to watch that happen. And right up to the very end, you know, like we find out that of course, Butch has never shot anybody, but then again, he's like, I got to go out there and get the bullets because they're almost out. Because he's like, I can't shoot, so you're going to have to cover me. And, you know, then when he does it, he doesn't do it right, you know. And Sundance is like, well, if I knew you were going to be not, you know, taking it easy or whatever, you know, if you were going to run like that, I would have, you know, it's like they.
This is Iron Man. This is Cap and Tony.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, like, even though they're criminals, this movie invented and is the template for every buddy cop movie you've ever seen.
Yeah.
There is no movie, no relationship like this that predates this film. The closest I can think of is Hope and Crosby in The Road Pictures.
Yeah.
Probably.
But there's no level of seriousness attached to those films at all.
Sure.
But I mean, if it wasn't for this movie, you wouldn't have a Lethal Weapon or a Tango and Cash or a 48 Hours or, I mean, you can just go on and on and on. Like this movie invents that template, and every movie that comes after it owes a debt of gratitude. And I think they would tell you that. Bad Boys, you wouldn't have a bad. I mean,
oh, for sure.
You know, I mean, this is what major Hollywood action movies all harken back to.
Yeah.
And the same way every rom-com, I think, harkens back to It Happened One Night. Almost every like action movie or buddy cop style action movie harkens back to this film.
Yeah.
It's great right up until the end, but Butch ends up getting shot in the back as he's running with the gun belts that he got from the horses, and Sundance tried to cover him, but there's just too many, and yeah, they're taking out, Sundance is taking out as many as he can, but the entire Bolivian army shows up, so you know as soon as they go around that corner, they're done for. And again, I do like that they end with that freeze frame that's the cover and the poster and everything, because you don't need to see them blown to bits. Like,
right.
You knew they couldn't get out of it. It's really nice that your memory is preserved of the two of them, and they go out fighting and it freezes, and it's like, it's just a really nice way to end that film.
And that,
it's fun. I was, go ahead.
That Bolivian army thing, that's true. Like, that,
yeah,
occurred. Like, in fact, the studio initially was like, this whole Bolivian stuff, like, they're like, it's not believable. You need to rewrite that. And he's like, but it's all true. Like, they really,
yeah,
that,
here it is in the book.
They really did send the Bolivian army to kill them because they were so tired of all the havoc they were wreaking.
When the commander or whatever general goes up and they're like, yeah, there's two of them. There's these two guys, right, that have been taken out, all these different guys.
These two gringos.
He's like, two?
And it was so great. I know. I was. Oh. It was so great. Is it's all in Spanish.
Yeah.
And so it's like it hinges on the viewer having at least a rudimentary knowledge, yeah, of Spanish. But all you really need to know is that two in Spanish, yeah, is dos.
Dos.
Because they're like, right, going back and forth, and then you just hear them like dos. Like, oh, that can't be right.
Yeah.
It's fun. You know, I have a. I love to recast things.
Yeah.
And I think if they were to make the Avenger, it's funny now that Redford has been in Captain America. Redford was Captain America.
Oh yeah.
Like if they were to recast this back then, watching this now, not Duvall, Newman would have been Tony Stark.
Yeah, I can see.
Because he's got the snark, he's got the quick wit, he's got all that attitude, and Redford would have been Captain America.
That's funny.
And I think, and now seeing Redford has been in a Captain America movie, like, it's like, oh yeah, now I get it. Like, it makes sense why they put him. It wasn't a we'll get this old timey actor to be in this role. Like, he was that character.
Yeah, that's, you know, cool.
Yeah,
so it'd have been. It's very cool to see. It's a shame. Did they only do two movies together?
I believe so. I believe this is it. That's in the Sting.
That is a crime.
Yeah, and people think of them so much as a duo, but they were really only in two movies together. But they were two of the best. I know Butch Cassidy is 69, but it's essentially kind of kicks off the 70s, and
right,
and they're in two of the greatest movies of the 70s, essentially.
Easily.
Yeah.
Easily.
And and an example of, and I said this when we were talking about the Sting during Sting 2, is that just a fine example of Hollywood filmmaking at its finest, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I will also say, I just thought this was interesting. I watched this with my 15-year-old, so he's YouTube, video games, like that, and this movie held his attention beginning to end.
It doesn't stop.
He absolutely loved it.
Nice. Yeah. I think that is such a testament to the script again, because there's not that much action. Like, in the, especially when, yeah, you're running away, there's not that much action in a traditional sense, but because of the relationship and because there's so much to take in, you know, all the sights and sounds, it's
clever.
A mesmerizing movie.
Yeah, like every scene is clever and interesting.
Yes.
It's there's never just a, well, this is just a scene to establish this so we can do this other thing later. Every time they're establishing something, it's still clever or funny or engaging in a way other than just about revealing the story.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah,
it's just a great time at the movies.
It's a classic.
Yeah, for a reason, and justifiable.
For a reason.
Yeah. So I guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the table, and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at JoeyButts, BUTTS21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at KevinRBrackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. You can find the show online, Facebook.com/RealSpoilers. Like the page, join the group while you're there. Be sure and swing on by the group and let us know your thoughts on Butch Cassidy. Maybe you've never seen it. And this was your first experience with the two. We'd love, it's always fun to get people's take on a classic movie with coming at it with no real advanced knowledge. So
yeah.
And of course, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month you get all sorts of bonus content, and you help us out, and we appreciate that. So coming up on the next one, we will tackle the misbegotten sequel to this film, which is Butch and Sundance, The Early Days, unless you're this DVD manufacturer, and then it's Butch and Sundance, The Early Years. It will be a little bit of a different experience. So thanks for tuning in, and until next time, Grizzly Adams gives Bean a bear.
Raindrops keep falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun, and I said I didn't like the way he got things done.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.